Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
June 30th, 2013, episode number 41. Parasites, Diseases, and Viruses, Oh My. Hi everyone, this is Kevin England. I want to welcome you once again to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. There comes a time in your life when out of nowhere an idea pops in and it has a profound impact on the way that you operate. While preparing for a recent beekeepers meeting for our New Jersey Northwest branch, I came upon such an idea courtesy of our state apiarist Tim Schuler. Our feature today is going to be about maladies of the hive, and it comes very strongly from a Penn State handout that helps you understand all the different things that could occur. And when talking about parasites, which is one of my least favorite things to discuss, because if you start talking about all the things that could go wrong, you might go running and screaming from the possibility that you could ever have success in keeping bees. So the idea that helps serve this around is to pivot it, and this is what Tim Schuler says. Don't look for not normal, look for normal. Know what normal is, and when you know what normal is, you will then understand when not normal is there. That is such a simple concept. So today's feature will talk about what is normal in your hive and how to discover when things are not normal and what to do about that. We might as well run down what else we have in the agenda today. Monsanto, known to beekeepers. Some think they're okay, others think they are not okay. I'll leave it at that. But are they coming to the rescue of bees? We'll have a discussion about that in segment number two. Segment number three, pop quiz, hotshot. We're going to run through a couple questions that have come through recently and ask you if you have an opinion on how to solve some problems for people who pose these questions, and we're looking for some interesting answers. Segment number four, tower hives. We did a little stint recently on Mr. Tim Ives, and that has spurred a lot of interest in the New Jersey region. We're going to talk about three box systems and a lot of tower hives that have graced the skies of New Jersey. Then we'll get into roundtable. Want to cover off the mesh bee suit I acquired earlier this spring, my new hive tool, and we'll talk about the swarm report update and a number of other things. So let's jump right in. We know that the first thing we always start with around these neck of the woods is the local hive report. When we last left you, things were looking a little bit bleak in the local hive report. We had gone from three hives to one, and two of them were queenless. Well, it turns out maybe that's not necessarily true. The one hive was completely operational, and let's just start with that. We'll call it hive number two. It is really operational. It's been a while since we've had a chance to talk to you, and that hive has just gone berserk this year. We literally had it up to about seven boxes or eight boxes, a combination of deeps and mediums before we split it off and made a bunch of different hives out of it. We'll put that one on hold right now. Hive number two was a hive that came out of winter with a small cluster of bees and no evidence of a queen. And hive number three looked pretty much the same. What I did with hive number two was take a queen from the mentoring yard, insert it in there, and get her started. I thought for good measure I'd give her some bees out of hive number three. Lo and behold, what we found out is hive number three actually did have a queen. The number of inspections that I did not provide any evidence of a queen. There was no brood, no anything going on. But after combining the two hives, and the way that I did that was I took an empty box, put it on top of hive number two, and then took hive number three, which was queenless and had maybe two, three frames of bees on it, and put it on top and combined them. Well, lo and behold, subsequent inspections found a queen down in the bottom, the marked one that we received, and a queen up in the top. It was a late discovery one afternoon while finishing up, and I had to run to a soccer game, so I left the two queens in there. Went back the next day and could never find the second queen. Presumably, though, the lower queen, which was in the bottom box, was found in the top box. My guess is, the lower queen found the upper queen and offed it, and she is the winner. Now there was a one queen box. It was really an odd experiment, so to speak, because you had a cluster of bees in the bottom, a somewhat empty box but with drawn comb in the middle, and a box up in the top, and they both, the bottom and the top box, had brood in them. So I let the box be for a week just to see what would happen. I was curious as to how it was going to develop. All the brood on the bottom got capped, got hatched, and that whole brood chamber collapsed. The one on the top thrived a little bit, but languished. This queen that we brought from the mentoring hive location, which is the Northwest New Jersey location, it was a queen that had maybe a cup and a half bees left over from the time that we pulled it off. It was slow and slow and slow. For 3 weeks, it did nothing. And then all of a sudden, that queen, for some reason, kicked in and started laying brood. And the last time we looked in there, there were four full frames of brood. And that box was starting to fill out, and they were bringing in pollen and honey. So we left that box to its devices. I did, at some point, collapse it down to two boxes. So it was a reasonable configuration and didn't have so much space they could defend the whole thing. And right now, that box is a fully operational hive. Not to the point where it's going to swarm, but running okay. And we recently put on a medium super to let it honey up. So, hive number one, going great. Hive number two and three combined, slow to start, but eventually, probably early to mid-June, finally came together and became a fully functioning hive. Not too enamored with that queen, but the expectation was that hive is going to be broken apart at some point and taken to the fair and put into observation boxes. So whatever happens to it, happens to it. Now the big box, what becomes of it? It was bursting at the seams, and if you've listened to one of our recent episodes, we talked about pyramiding up and checkerboarding. Those techniques include breaking the brood chamber up to give it more room to operate, and breaking the honey area up to make more room for storage. That box literally had 7 or 8 boxes on it, and it totally filled the whole thing up to the point where it was due to swarm again. So in the beginning of June, we brought out all of our equipment from the garage and put a number of boxes out and split and split and split. Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. What I did originally was pull a nuke out, probably the end of May, and I pulled 2 frames of brood out of it with new eggs and put it inside the nuke and let them build queen cells. When I went out back in the beginning of June and looked at it, it was probably the first week, say June 7th, there was a really strong nectar flow, lots of pollen going on, all the hives were doing really well, and I had 2 or 3 frames of queen cells. Perfect, perfect timing for us. So we took a little brood from here, and took a little brood from there, and took a little pollen from here, and a little pollen from there, and a little honey stores from here, and a little honey stores from there. Basically took that 7-box setup and split it up, and in the end, made a number of hives out of it. So when we finished splitting, I was able to put together 3 new configurations, plus the mentoring hive queen, plus the original box. Now, the original box went from 7 to 5, as I was able to collapse it down after distributing some of its wares. But it's none the worse for the wear. At the end of June, the box is completely hopping, and they're still going to town. The queen is laying brood like crazy, and they're bringing in stores. They filled two honey boxes, and it's back to a tower box. All the other hives are fully functional, at least one box, and have a second box due any day now from the splits. So we're up to five hives. And then it turns out I get a phone call from work, and my wife Sharon works at an elementary school, and they had a swarm hanging in one of their trees sitting in the courtyard. So we went and collected that and put that one up. So now we are up to six boxes in the apiary. And I still have three or four left in the garage. And maybe we'll do a late summer split and get some nukes set up. And I still would like to put my top bar hive into play. So plenty of things to do for the summer. It's been a strange spring, but no stranger than the last couple, I guess. We've seen a lot of cool weather in the beginning of spring and a lot of rain here in New Jersey, which has been good rain. It's been heavy rain, but it's been rain and then it stops for a number of days, and then it rains and then it stops for a number of days. In fact, as we record this, it has just started raining, and it's supposed to rain over the next couple days after being stormy every night. It almost seems like Florida weather around here. It's hot, humid, and storming at night. But the good news is this keeps the plants, and I'm no expert at plants, so I'll make this up because it's my thoughts. It keeps the plants plump. It keeps them moist, wet. They're making a lot of nectar is my guess. And we've been through the cycles of the trees blooming. The locust is out. See, a lot of clover this year looks really good. And the bees are doing extremely well at a lot of the collections. So that's where we stand. Local Hive reports six hives on the property. One of them really banging. The rest of them are all kind of coming together, and suspect that we'll have some really strong hives going into July. So this week is the 4th of July coming up. Going to have Thursday off, which is the 4th. May think about sneaking off on Friday. And if I do that, I'll probably go in and see how the hives are doing. What I'd really like to do at some point is pull one of those hives apart, cut the comb out, and put it in my top bar hive and get that started for the year. And also, I want to take all of the frames out of one of the hives and put it in one of my new cedar hives that I have sitting there that I wanted to try. I took the hive and covered it with boiled linseed, and that hive is ready to go. And maybe this 4th of July, 5th of July, or the following weekend, we'll get the opportunity to go take care of some things and keep working in the apiary and keep the local hives running along smoothly. So that's it for the local hive report. Six hives on the property, and we'll see how summer management goes. Not really suspecting a lot of varroa mite problems, but we will, in July and August, test for our varroa mite and make sure that we keep those thresholds down. I think you've heard me say that before. So that's it for Local Hive Report. Let's get to segment number one. We're going to talk about the new normal. I recently had a chance to do a presentation for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association, for which I am an officer. And one of the topics we talked about is hive maladies. This comes from a Penn State presentation PDF document that's available on the website. And it goes through a number of things: American foul brood, European foul brood, different viruses and pests that could be problems for your hive. I started having a discussion with the state apiarist about how overwhelming this is, and the fact that when you start talking about these, while they're very interesting to know, it becomes very difficult for someone to retain. And specifically, it becomes very daunting because every time you think about these things, you think you're seeing them over and over again. The other thing is, it's just far too much to remember. So how does one who is maybe in our realm a novice, how do they reconcile all this? And going back to the intro, his comment was, stop looking for all these problems and just figure out what normal is and know when normal is not present, and then you should do something about it. And then from there, if you know some basics, you could probably discern what you are dealing with and potentially have a course of action, or you pick up the phone and you give somebody a call. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to talk about a number of things: brood problems, bee problems, disease problems, and so on. And I'm going to go through what's not normal, and then we're going to get to that epiphany where we talk about how to actually discern what normal is. And I'm going to give you a homework assignment. So let's start first with brood problems. Brood problems come in a number of formats, one of the first ones being American foul brood. When you have American foul brood, you probably know it because there's this odor that emanates from your hive that is not normal. You'll see different signs of American foul brood, and it's probably one of the more serious things. So we're going to start with that first, hoping you retain this. If you see discolored, punctured, or sunken capping in your hives, contrast to the convex, sealed, nicely colored larvae that you typically see, you know that there's a potential for American foul brood. When you look at that puncture, it's there for a reason. The bees have opened that puncture up so that they can signal to somebody to remove that bee that's in there. Now, what are you going to see behind the puncture, or what are you going to see when American foul brood is present? The larvae is going to degrade from a pearly white to light brown to dark brown to a coffee color. It has a distinct odor, and the dead larvae dry out and create a scale. If you catch it before it dries out, you could stick a twig or something like that in there, a toothpick, and when you pull it out, it has a distinctive rope to it. It becomes like snot. It sticks out, and it has a chocolate cover. Another thing you could look for is what's called pupal tongue. The proboscis could be stuck to the cell wall top. Now, when this dries out, you would look down from the top of the frame, and you will see a scale. This is a dried-out larvae that is stuck to the inside, not easy to remove. If you have American foul brood, run, don't walk, to call somebody and get them to solve this problem. You're going to have to possibly get rid of your frames and torch your equipment, or literally burn all your stuff. But this is serious. If you have American foul brood, you want to take action on that. So switching gears, European foul brood is not the same thing as American foul brood, but it generally kills the larvae that are 2 to 4 days old while they are still C-shaped in the bottom of the cells. The other ones, the cells were capped. So most of the larvae die before their cells are capped. You'll see a spotty brood pattern of capped and uncapped cells when EFB becomes serious. This is something that doesn't kill colonies, but heavy infections could seriously affect its population growth. The most significant symptom of European foul brood, EFB, is the non-uniform color change of the larvae. It'll be pearly on one end, it'll be coffee-colored on the end. They change from white to yellowish to brown, and finally they become gray, and they become blotchy or mottled. This is not something that you can miss, because you know when you're looking down into a frame and you see pearly white, if it's not pearly white, you have something going on. The infected larvae lose their plump appearance. They look undernourished. There's a bunch of different things going on here. It appears sometimes twisted or melted to the bottom of the cell. Terramycin is the only product labeled for control of European foul brood. And typically what you find is you can put a couple doses and solve the problems there. One of the things to note between European foul brood and American foul brood is the dead larvae from EFB form a thin brown or blackish brown scale that can be easily removed. So American foul brood can't get that scale out. European foul brood, you can. That's how you tell the difference between the two. Now I'm talking here about brood problems, But actually, one brood problem is really a bee problem. When you have varroa, you're going to see bee problems. Deformed wing, you're going to see problems with the bees because they have viruses that are vectored, likely from varroa infestation. You'll see hairless, greasy bees. You'll see bees crawling away, extended abdomens. They just have problems. But one of the things you see with varroa is you see scattered irregular patterns, uncapped cells. This is because the hygienic bees are cleaning up after them. A bee walks past, knows there's varroa in there. If it's a varroa-sensitive hygiene bee, it's going to uncap it. Somebody's going to pull it out, and you may potentially see holes in your brood pattern because of varroa. If you see a sudden fall off or collapse, then you're potentially dealing with varroa problems. Now, parasitic mite syndrome, which is a side effect of having varroa infestations, also give you spotty brood patterns and dead brood found in cells. They'll be yellow brown or dark brown brood. Sounds like AFP, right? Here's the difference. These do not rope out. If you have parasitic mite syndrome, it does not rope out. The other bee problem that comes while I'm hitting bee problems is trachea mites. It's a mite that gets into the breathing tube of the adult honeybee. It gets into that spiracle. If you remember one of our episodes, we talked about these. They're the holes that are in the sides of the bee that they breathe through. They pump their abdomen in and out, much the way you work a smoker, and they're drawing air into the abdomen chambers. It's no bigger than a speck, but the tracheal mite can fit inside that hole. The trachea mite, it affects the life of the bees. It shortens it. And what you typically see is infested colonies die in late winter or early spring. They're hard to detect and usually require a microscope. So there's really not much you could do about this, and you really can't worry about it. A severe infestation can be identified in the field by detaching the head from the thorax to expose the large tracheal trunks in the thorax. It's most easily done with the drone bees, and normally these tracheal tubes are opaque. When you have high infestation of mites, the tubes will be blotchy with patches of brown or black. And if it's particularly severe, the tubes could be solid black. Hold on a minute, folks. Kevin moment. Come on, are you really going to be pulling the heads off the thorax and all that looking? No, nobody in their right mind is going to do this. If you have a trachea mite problem, you're completely oblivious to this. Typically, it's not something that impacts the bees, and it's not something you could do about it. If you did want to send your bees over to Beltsville Lab or someplace like that where they could tell you you have this problem, all the better, right? But for the most part, don't worry about these folks. There's not much you could do about it. You're not going to be able to see it. I doubt you're going to be out there inspecting your bees. Let's just put it this way. I don't even think commercial guys are doing this type of thing. And I don't know about you, but I've never pulled the head from the thorax, exposed the large tracheal trunks to see whether they were brown or blotchy or black. I just haven't done it. So let's roll on here. Okay. Back to brood problems. Let's talk about a thing called chalk brood. This is something you'll see, and it is something you can realize when you do see it. The dead larvae are chalky white and usually covered with fungus filaments that have a fluffy, cotton-like appearance. If they be dead for a long time, they might be black. You might find these throughout your brood-rearing season. Usually you see it late in the spring when the brood nest is growing rapidly. They're also found on the outer fringes of the brood nest, where there aren't enough nurse bees to maintain the brood nest temperature. If you're chilling the bees or you're doing something like this, you could potentially see this chalk brood. And drone brood is always left at the outside of the hive, so it's the most susceptible to this type of situation. So what are you going to see? Chalk brood, what you typically see is mummies found out in front of the hive or on the landing board. In strong colonies, most of these will be discarded by worker bees outside the hive. Eventually, they're going to pull these mummies out and get rid of them. It reduces the possibility of reinfection when they pull them out and they get rid of them. And so here's the thing. If you want to do this, just make sure you have a healthy colony and you shouldn't have this issue. One thing that you might do is improve ventilation so that you have proper temperature controls inside your hive. So one more brood problem to make you aware of. It's called sac brood. This is dead brood that's scattered among the healthy brood. Similar to the discussion we had before, they'll perforate the cell and then somebody else will come back later and remove the affected brood. How do you know if you have sac brood? You're going to see this larvae that is gross looking. It's pearly white in the beginning, but it becomes dull yellow or gray and finally black. The head of the larvae is the first part to change. It becomes black. And they die in a stretched out position with their head raised. So these are typically like little morsels. You could just pop them right out. They stay intact. They're easily removed from the cell. Sac brood is just sac brood. It's something that happens. There's not much you could do about it. It almost always happens throughout your hive, and the bees just take care of it, and they move along with their lives. Hopefully, you're not hugely infested. If you are, then something else is going on. But for the most part, nothing to see here. Move along. So the next thing I want to talk about, we've discussed this on the show here, is Nosema. There's two types, Nosema apis, Nosema serrani. It's a fungus that affects honeybees. It's pretty common and widespread throughout your colony. Go out in your hive right now, test them, they have Nosema. It's a given. There's really not much you could do about it, and symptoms are nonspecific. Said another way, you can't detect this in a bee without a microscope. You might see fecal staining on the outside of the hive. It's called dysentery. And you might notice bees with diseased honeybee guts. But no, you're not going to. And this is the thing. At the end of the year when you're feeding them sugar water and you're feeding them and feeding them and feeding them and they don't have enough time to ripen it and then they eat that and they get dysentery and people say, oh my God, my hive has collapsed because of Nosema. No, it's because they had unripened honey, which fermented, and they ate that and made them sick. So you see dysentery, it doesn't necessarily mean Nosema. If you go to scientificbeekeeping.com, Randy Oliver's site, he will teach you how to look for this. You need a microscope. You got to crush a bee. You're looking for it. I really don't. This is, again, one of those things you can't see, and you really can't do much about it. Now, there is treatment for this, Fumitil B. It treats Nosema apis, not Nosema serrani. The problem here is most of the bees have serrani, not apis. So if you're treating them with Fumitil or Fumigellin is the name of the product, you're probably not doing yourself a service because it's extremely hard on the bees. Would you give your children penicillin or some form of medication if they didn't need it or you knew that it would serve no purpose? Treating with Fumitil without knowing that you're treating the literal Nosema that you need to treat is the same thing. Don't do it, folks. Just leave it be. Healthy bees generated over time through new brood and healthy patterns, that solves the issue. You're not going to treat this Nosema. That's my thoughts here. Now, virus problems is another issue that you have. There's 11 in North America, and many, they really don't have a significant impact on colonies unless you're infected with parasites. What are they? Black queen cell virus, deformed wing, chronic paralysis, trembling syndrome, which causes hive abandonment, hairless black syndrome, greasy hairless bees, bees with K wings, Israeli acute paralysis virus. Listen, here's the story about these. Don't worry about them. What you need to worry about is varroa, which vectors these viruses. If you have Varroa in your hive, you're going to have the virus. So take care of your Varroa problem and don't worry specifically about the viruses. Now, if this wasn't bad enough, you have pests. These are things that are not normal. Hive beetles, bears, skunks, possum, mice, wasps, wax moths, termites, earwigs, ants, things that approach the hive that you have no control over, or maybe you do, but they are attacking the hive. Remember, you're out in the wild here with these things, and sometimes these are problems that are not normal in the apiary. So, if that isn't bad enough, drones and worker cells, bullet caps, egg layers, laying workers, dysentery, you need ventilation and feeding, ripen the honey, pesticide kills, winter kills, starvation, robbing. Hold on a minute. Do you give up yet? Do you give up yet? I hope not. Let's turn the corner here. So I just ran through this, and I don't know how long I've been talking, but I know it's been a while. We've run through a number of things here. But the fact of the matter is, most of you have never seen these things. Up until that presentation when the state apiarist brought an American fowl brood frame, I had never seen it. And it's probably something you won't see, and hopefully you won't have to deal with. So how do we turn this corner? Let's talk about normal, or the way it should be. I want you to start with the end in mind. A normal hive. A hive requires a healthy population made up of three things. A healthy queen, a working population that includes drones, and adequate pollen and nectar stores along with sources of water. So what's your job? Your job is to recognize normal. If you can recognize normal, then you can recognize when things don't match up. Normal hives have bees that look good, good brood patterns, normal comb, simple fundamentals. That's where we need to stay. So what's the leading indicator? It's brood. Brood is the promissory note that your hive has a strong future. In the stage of development, you go from eggs to larvae. The queen lays one egg in a cell. It deposits in a pool of royal jelly. The egg transforms into a C-shaped larvae, and healthy larvae are pearly white and glisten. They almost have a blue iridescent glow to them. They look so pretty. When they reach a certain stage of development, they are capped off with medium brown cappings. They're convex, meaning domed, not concave, sunken in, and they have a solid pattern of cells with infrequent uncapped or open cells. The brood, in a typical frame, is centered and it's surrounded by a horseshoe band of pollen. And you have nectar in the periphery. Often it's capped up in the corners. You'll also find drone larger at the end of the brood nest. So think about it. Brood is the leading indicator. Nice pattern of frame right through the middle. Horseshoe of pollen around the outside. Nectar stored up in the corners. This is normal. It should look like that. And you've all seen that. What did we say the other thing was? Adult bees. Bees emerge and they get to work. They're shiny bees covered with hair, healthy wings, and proper proportions. They look good. If you've ever seen a bee in the spring, it looks like the Cadillac. It looks great. It looks healthy. You could stand at a hive in the springtime and look at it and say, boy, those bees are the most beautiful bees in the world. Contrary to a bee that is just not healthy, has deformed wing, looks skinny, doesn't have the right colors. I mean, listen, sometimes bees are worn out in a heavy forage where they go out, they come back, they're hairless. That little thing at the top of their abdomen is black because all the hair has been worn off because they've worked so hard, their wings are in tatters. you could tell the difference between a healthy bee and a forager that's at the end of its life and a sick bee if you look at the bees. And you've heard me say this before on the podcast, so here it goes again. Look at your bees. People don't look at the bees. They pick up the frame, they look at the brood, they look in the holes, they look at this, they look at that, and they never look at the bees. Look at the bees. They're beautiful. The girls are beautiful. The boys are nice. Look at them. They should look healthy. They should have nice color. Recognize their colors and their patterns and their shapes and their size. Are they plump? Are they healthy looking? You know, the adult bees should be a ratio of 2 adults to each capped brood cell during a working season. So the other part of bees is having enough of them. When you open your hive, is it bursting with bees? Does it have frames that are covered? Are there enough people to take care of the brood in there? I mean, these are the things that you should be looking for. Last part of the equation, capped honey, nectar stores, pollen stores. This is the refrigerator of the hive. They need these things. They need the honey for the carbohydrate. They need the pollen, and they need the propolis, and they need water. They need all 4 of those things to operate. Uncapped honey can have multiple appearances, but typically when you look down into the cell, it has a dark black glass appearance. And fresh honey is capped white, but it turns brown over time when they walk on it. That's okay. The other thing that you see is bee bread. Sometimes you'll see pollen stuffed in the bottom of the cell. It comes 2 forms. It comes from just the way you see it on their legs when they come in the hive. And then you see it where it undergoes a lactic acid fermentation, and it's covered with a thin film of nectar. Bee bread, when it's processed, is like a little capsule in there, and it becomes hard, and it's about half the height of the depth of the cell. You look in your hive, and you'll recognize what it should look like. Now, there's a couple other things besides brood, bees, and stores that you're going to see in a hive that is normal. Nothing to be worried about. First one is queen cells. You'll find them in the spring or late summer. It's normal when conditions are strong that they are present. You're going to find a cup in the middle of the cell, at the bottom of the frame, wherever. They're normal. Bees keep them around in case they need something, in case something happens to the queen. And sometimes they're going to be capped. That's just a normal process. Think about how bees swarm to propagate the species. Hopefully you're managing your bees and preventing them from capping the cells. But if you do see capped cells, it's a signal that something's going on. So when you see these queen cups protruding from the side of the frame, and you look down in and they're empty and there's no larvae, there's no egg, there's no pool of royal jelly, that's normal, not something to be concerned about. When you see them cap them off, though, you know that they're making a new queen for some reason, which isn't necessarily a bad thing unless something's happened to the queen. That's not necessarily normal, but they know how to take care of that. You also find sometimes you'll see a queen cup that's recently emerged. You'll literally see the flap hanging down, or you'll see frayed edges. On occasion, you may even see one with a hole in the side where they've chewed through and killed whatever was inside to control it. So when you think about all the stuff we started this segment with, and you think about the normal is far easier to look for. Normal brood, normal bees, normal stores. Occasionally, you see a queen cell. If you don't see these things, then you're not looking at normal. So you have a homework assignment. Next time you go out into your hive, whatever your objective is, break it down, go through it, and look at it. Presumably, your hives are normal. Presumably, they're healthy. So look at them now while they look good and figure out what normal looks like. Look in your colonies in New Jersey, for example, right now. We're still at the nectar flow stage. And we have strong, healthy colonies. Observe what they look like on a good day. Build mental notes with a vision that when something turns up to you, you're going to say, uh-oh, something doesn't look quite right. Now, what happens if you don't see normal and you don't know what to do about it? You want to take the appropriate action. Hopefully, we've given you some signs of what's not normal, and you could go check out the field guide to honeybees and their maladies. We'll provide a link to this in our show notes, but you can look for that name, A Field Guide to Honeybee and Their Maladies, published from Penn State. Make sure you get it from their site, because people have taken copies, even older copies of this, and posted it up. You want to go to Penn State's site and get it directly from them so that you have the latest one. I think it was just updated not too long ago, so it's actually very current and very good. And all those things that are not normal that I read about, I covered in summary terms. If you really, really want to know them, and it's not a bad idea, go read that guide. It has a really good head start for the novice beekeeper to look at it. Sometimes it's technical, but you can handle it. If you're listening to the show, our audience can handle it. Last thing is good inspection procedures. Keep normal normal. And what I mean by that is never touch your hive without first gently smoking the colony. We prefer that you don't wear weather gloves. Leather gloves are a problem because they risk disease transmission. Nitrile gloves, good idea, but change them after every site. And this is especially true if you have bees from one site to another to another. If you can go gloveless, I'm now of that mind. I think it's possible. I don't get stung on the hand as much as I used to. Occasionally I take a sting, but most of the time it's my own fault. But I am far better in my hives having gone gloveless. If you're not there yet, use your gloves and follow the recommendations that we've had in the past on that. Here's an idea that we've talked about, and I'm going to refresh it because I haven't talked about it again. Go in the bottom of your colony first and inspect there. What you're doing is you're taking the top boxes off, you're putting them on the inner cover, and you're putting the inner cover, you're putting them on the outer cover. Then you're putting the inner cover on that, and you're working in the bottom box. When you're finished toiling around in the bottom box, you take the next box and you put it on top. Those bees go back to business. You've disturbed them, but now you put them back. The other bees have been sitting on the side with the inner cover sitting on top of them. While they're not in a normal place, they're not as disturbed. And you work from the bottom up. Always pull an outside frame first to minimize the possibility of crushing your queen. My recommendation is use the second frame. When you pull the second frame, you have bees against bees on both sides of the frame. You don't roll the bees as much, and you don't risk crushing bees. If you pull that first frame literally on the outside, unless there's nothing there, like its foundation, you risk pinching the bees between the frame and the outside box. And then last but not least, what should always be normal to you is be gentle with your bees, and they will usually be gentle with you. So there you have it, a concept to live by. Think about normal, go in your hive and watch for normal, and when you don't see normal, then it is time to take the action to do about it. Don't forget your homework assignment. Go in and look at your hives, kind of look at the bees, look at the construction of your hive, and get yourself set to what normal is. And we will probably carry this theme throughout our history here at the Beekeeper's Corner, and thank Tim Schuler always for the concept of how to work through parasites and diseases and viruses, oh my. Segment number two, Monsanto to the rescue. Agrochemical company Monsanto recently held a three-day event, including 100 members of the bee community. Different beekeepers that spoke include Diana Cox Foster, a professor of entomology at Penn State University, well-known commercial beekeeper and past president of the ABF, Dave Mendes, Gus Rouse, Larry Johnson, and others. along with Jerry Hayes, who runs the Monsanto bee industry efforts. The discussion focused on Monsanto's partnership with beekeepers to discover what is killing the honeybees. Monsanto has made significant investments in collaboration in R&D for honeybee health. One such investment is the September 2011 purchase of BeeLogix. BeeLogix was a company that is pursuing a product called Remibee, which is fed to adult bees in sugar syrup, and the dsRNA vaccinates the cells of the bees so that they can attack specific viruses if they show up as a real virus. This is a little technical, so I won't go into that, and I don't even know if I said that correctly, but one of the things is it allows the bees to become immune to IAPV, one of the things we just talked about in segment number one. Continuing studies reveal that this is passed through the bee into the larvae in the pupae and then appears in the emerging adults. The premise of this is that the varroa work on the adults, and it could be delivered through varroa in the honeybee life cycle change. And if varroa could do it, it's going to cure the virus inside the varroa and stop the vectoring of the virus. That might be a little bit of a stretch in the way that I presented it, but I assume that's where it's going. And it sounds like that is the angle here. So Monsanto has an agrochemical business. They're interested in proving that varroa does this because of the fact that they manufacture the special adhesive seed coating that is applied to clothianidin, one of the neonicotinoids that is used in the processing and delivery of corn and other plants. As Monsanto goes, they have an interest to demonstrate that varroa is the problem and not so much the neonicotinoids in the way that it works. So all that aside, it's not my premise here to vilify Monsanto. In fact, in an article I read recently from Dr. Musson from UC Davis, he actually went to this summit that they had, and one of the things he talked about was how does Monsanto see this problem where the seed coatings are blowing off in distribution of the seeds to the public, right? This is one of the things to the public, no, to the ground. So the premise is the seed coating is coming off with the chemical and distributing through the air in part of the distribution of trying to get the seed from whatever it is in the machine down into the ground, and it was never supposed to be exposed to the bee in the first place. Dr. Musson pressed them on this issue. In his latest newsletter, he talks about the conversation he had with them, and he indicates that Monsanto formulated the coating that attaches firmly to the seed, and it is slippery as it's supposed to be. However, downstream companies coat the seeds with their own additional products that can make the seeds sticky again, and then the talc is required to allow the seeds to pass successfully through the planter, and the toxic dust problem returns. There's always more to the story when you start to learn about these things. So one has no idea whether this Remibee product will ever come to fruition, but it is an interesting aspect. And the way I see it, if Monsanto is going to contribute to this effort, then all the better, right? We do know varroa is a problem. We just talked about that in segment number one. So why not let them work on it? The conversation, at least one of the takes from Dr. Musson, is if it wasn't for a company with the size and facility like Monsanto helping out, this may not have ever been an option for them to get to market. So I see it as a good thing. It'll be really interesting to see where Monsanto comes on this and whether they can solve the talc problem, right? I heard when we went to January's American Beekeeping Conference during one of the talks that that was something that someone had said they were working on and possibly had a solution on. So it's not like they're not aware of it. Does that change whether neonicotinoids are really a problem or not? Hard to say. And if you think about what they've done in Europe, well, the jury is still out, apparently. So where did it all end up? I'm not exactly sure. I've seen pros and cons, and I won't stand on the sideline and try and figure out what the outcome of this thing was. One thing that I did read is that the USDA and EPA are holding another three-day honeybee pesticide meeting in Virginia. Dr. Musson reports it's October 15, 2013, and everybody that was invited to the summit was invited to attend this also. As he writes, this is really good news. It demonstrates that beekeepers and now the general public are being taken seriously about their concerns over the health of honeybees and the possible contributions pesticides and pesticide residues may be playing in the excess honeybee colony losses. So that's the one thing we heard consistently leading up to this year's ABF conference, is that the beekeepers, specifically the commercial guys and the public beekeepers, were not really being listened to, that the studies and the evidence that we're presenting to the EPA was being ignored. The EPA was sitting on their hands. And now, if you believe what I just read, possibly they are starting to listen up. I always try to remain rather neutral on this. I'm really looking for the tidbits of science that are going to tell you one thing or the other versus trying to be an alarmist about these things. Is there a problem? Yeah, I'm sure there's a problem. It'll be interesting to see what happened in Europe with the banning of some of the neonicotinoids and what kind of impact that has in a year's time. We'll be sitting in a different place with more data to work from. But in the meantime, an open dialogue between the USDA, the EPA, and the Beekeeping Society is really important, and it's a good positive step. I've pretty much covered everything I wanted to say about this during this segment, but I will encourage you, go look at the May-June 2013 Cooperative Extension newsletter from Dr. Musson, UC Apiaries, University of California. There were a number of capture points from the Monsanto event that he captured. Very interesting things about how to sample, when to sample, on-site investigations, different reports that were given, how Canada is managing some of these conversations and things like that. Far too much for me to cover here, but worth your look. So go to our show notes at www.bkcorner.org, and we'll have a link over to Dr. Musson's newsletters, including the May-June 2013 issue. It's a very interesting read. For this segment, segment number three, I wanted to get into something a little bit lighter and not so sciencey. So, pop quiz is the title here. On a recent forum, I saw a question with a picture of a hive sitting there. Two hives, side by side, on a bench. One of them has a huge mass of bees hanging off the outer cover. The quiz question is it a swarm or is it bearding? Do you know the answer? The answer is you can't tell. That's the answer. Trick question here. Now let me lay this out a different way. It's the middle of spring, plenty of forage, lots of nectar, pollen available, a thriving, healthy colony, and you have the same situation. Now answer the question, is it a swarm? Wait a minute, you don't have enough information. And maybe you'll never have enough information, but let's cover this. Is it really, really hot outside? So bees do come outside of the box. This is the trick part of the pop quiz. This is called bearding, and they collect on the outside of the box for the purpose of cooling off and also for the purpose of changing the dynamic inside the hive. If it's very hot outside, or there's just far too many bees to operate inside the hive, sometimes a cluster of bees will come out and attach itself to the outside of the hive. In the cool evening air, it will go back inside, or maybe it'll hang out all night long. That's part of the temperature control mechanism. But if you find the cluster hanging off the cover, that's a different story altogether. If it's a thriving hive, with more than its share of bees, more than its share of forage and population and storage and all those things, and the bees come out to swarm, it is possible that it issued from the swarm, the box next to it, or it issued out and they only went as far as hanging off the inner cover. If assessing the situation, one would determine how is the hive or hives, being that there were two of them sitting together, how are they? Are they in a swarm mode? Are there swarm cells present or whatever? You may never really know the answer to this, but eventually that swarm will either fly away or go back inside the box. So when you're staring at something hanging off your hive, take in all the mental notes, what is normal, and figure out whether or not it exited because it's ready to swarm or because it's just too hot and there's too many bees and not enough room for them to operate inside. That's pop quiz number one. Number two. You receive a report from a new beekeeper that they've recently installed two hives out of packages earlier this spring. They've been feeding and feeding and feeding them. And hive number one is doing great, and they've been able to put a second box on, and hive number two is not. They have one box, they're not looking very good, and they have queen cells showing up in that box. Pop quiz, what do you do with hive number two? Do, 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 do. So I've been asked this question twice in the last week. One of them, the hive actually got built from a nuke, and the other one got built from a fresh package. And the answer to the quiz is, you do nothing, as far as I'm concerned. If you have a box that is slow, you could potentially pinch the queen off, but that box is not doing really well. It's either the queen didn't get mated well, or it's just a slow starter. This is why they recommend you build two hives when you start, so that you have one to compare and contrast against. If one is not doing well, either the queen was not mated well, and you should pinch her off and replace her, or let her be and keep feeding her. This is a key, though. Keep feeding and look at your feed. Look at your internal feeder. Look at your on-top feeder, whichever kind you're using, or are you using the proper feeder? If you're not using the proper feeder, that hive is not going to thrive very well. Here's the deal. If you're using a Boardman feeder, one of those mason jar types that at the front entrance, a thriving colony will go through those in about an hour. You want to have a serious quantity of food for them to eat when they need it. A top feeder lets you put gallons of food on, not quarts. And if you put a division board feeder inside the hive, it's right in with the hive, and you could keep pouring that in again, gallons or a gallon of feed instead of quarts. You want to keep feeding new hives this time of year and ensure that they have enough carbohydrate and food so that they could continue to build wax and build the hive out. They can't do it without it. They also need the water in there to process the food, to work with the wax, to use the cooling, and all the other things that we've talked about here on the podcast. So the quiz was, what do you do with hive number two? Leave it alone or do something with it? The answer is, if you're feeding it regularly, I would say leave it alone because you can't get a good queen at this point anyway. At least not in New Jersey. Generally, any queen that you get at this time of year is an afterthought, unless you're pulling a queen cell out of some other place. So as I think about it, is it really a quiz? It's really kind of a question, what would you do? Maybe I'll have to rename the segment, but we're going to let it roll. Let's see if we got one more for you. Okay, number three, the last one. And this one I will make a quiz question. Let's do it that way. Maybe I could figure this out now that I'm on the third one. All right, here's your question. Honeybees, they love honeysuckle. True or false? Do, 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 do. Okay, you got your answer? What's the answer? The answer is, they can't get to honeysuckle. Because most of them have long, trumpety-type flowers, and the bees can't get their proboscis in to get to the nectar. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. This is a trick question. Bees have figured out an answer to this. They've developed an unusual system for taking honeysuckle nectar. because their bodies are too large to get inside the bloom, they poke holes in the outside of the flower and take honeysuckle nectar without pollinating the blooms. Ingenious little bees, bad for the honeysuckle because it does not get pollinated. But bees can actually get to it. That's very interesting. I never knew that, but just found that recently. So there's your pop quiz section. Hope you enjoyed that. And if you have any pop quiz questions, send them along and we'll play pop quiz on future episodes. Segment number 4, Three Box and Towers. This one comes from Jason. I'm going to give him a call out. He's from letmbe.com, letmbee.com. Jason sent a note over recently with a bunch of pictures of hives that are 10, 11 boxes high. I talked about my 7 box. If I hadn't split it, I probably would have gotten that high. And he has a stepladder next to his hives. This runs into a new idea where Tim Ives came out earlier this year to New Jersey, as I mentioned in the opening. And a lot of people are starting to think about the 3-deep hive configuration. The premise of this is that you build your colony so big that you do not need to feed them when they come out in the spring. And theoretically, they're so strong they shouldn't need treatments and things like that. I don't know if I could quite buy all that yet, the treatment part, but they do come out as bee bombs in the spring, according to the way Tim shows it and the way that people are really getting on this year in New Jersey. I always wonder when these things happen, is the timing right, or is it just happened to be that somebody's onto something? Time will tell. I thought that after watching Tim's presentation earlier this year, how maybe the fact that his phenomena works for a couple of years, but then things change. We're going through a kind of a funny warming. We've had a real warm winter not too long ago. We've had a lot of rain a couple springs ago, a lot of rain this spring. I don't know what normal is anymore when it comes to weather. But I do believe that if you can build 3 deep boxes and over winter, you will come out stronger in the spring. And I think, and I know of several people that are going to try this year, they're going to go to 3 deep configurations here in New Jersey and see how they make out next spring. I know of 3 or 4 people that are doing that. I also know that a number of people I've seen in the New Jersey forums statewide have taken Tim's advice to heart and are building towers. Jason, not New Jersey, but saying that he in Indiana is having huge success with this. And if you hear what Tim has to say, he had a number of people around him running the old conventional way, 2 boxes, a couple honey supers. And now as he drives around Indiana, he sees stacks and stacks of hives, just like the way that he professes. So good for Tim. That's pretty exciting for him that he may have stumbled on this. I don't know whether it's fair to give him full credit from it, but if there's anybody that I've seen it from, it's him. And he was featured in Bee Culture, American Bee Journal. I don't remember which one. I've seen the article with Randy Oliver standing there next to him and these mountain hives. And it tells you that you can't get enough equipment, I guess. Maybe I could put all that stuff in my garage to use. So I'm having faith that this year I'm going to come out of winter with 3 deep hives and lots of honey to be made next year and lots of bees and nukes and so on. So 2 premises we'll be testing this year. One of them is multiple deeps and the other is nucleus overwinters. I am going to overwinter some nukes this year, but thinking about it, Michael Palmer method of overwintering nukes probably becomes unnecessary if this 3-deep hive configuration works out. So how do you do this? I guess you hedge your bets. You do both and see how something works out for you. That'd be interesting to see how it goes. But anyway, the new thing, the new phenomena here in New Jersey, just to keep you posted on the hip trends, is 3 boxes are in and these tower hives are really taking off. Starting to see a lot of people have success with that here and thought I'd pass that along. Incidentally, in the show notes, if Jason's okay with it, we'll post his pictures of his mountain hives. You'll see them. They're pretty impressive, so I'm sure he wouldn't mind. Or you could probably go see his site, letmbee.com. I'm assuming if you go over there, let me click on the link and see what I see. He probably has them posted over there. Hasn't posted. Oh, yeah, he did. This is terrible television here when you're... Sorry, folks. Let me cut some of this out. This kind of demonstrates this live recording model that I have. Sometimes it just goes on the fly. Yep, if you go to his site and click on his 2013-06-26 link, you'll see a picture of one of his large hives there. Pretty cool looking. So, very good. Thanks, Jason, for sharing that. Okay, we find ourselves about an hour into the podcast. Usually I find that's about as much as people could tolerate. So let me run through roundtable here. These are just a couple quick segments to kind of finish things off and give you a couple news and notes. First thing I wanted to talk about, segment number 5, Mesh B-Suit. I think I've mentioned this in the last couple episodes, but I've really had a chance to try it out lately. Usually I go out in short sleeve shirt, pants, and a veil, but I purchased a B-Suit, one of those mesh ones that are 3 layers. Has a layer of mesh inside a center opening, like a grid, and then a layer of mesh on the bottom. The premise of this is air can pass through, but a bee stinger cannot reach through. And you know what? They work. They're really cool. Like temperature cool. When you stand outside, even if there's the slightest breeze, you do sweat. Sorry, it's hot. You're going to sweat whether you have a coat on or not. But you do feel the air coming through and evaporating from your thing, and it's refreshing to work that way. Contrary to that, I have a Man Lake suit, the old traditional one, made of cloth canvas. And this thing, it's a sweat jacket. I mean, that's all it is. You put it on, and you're covered, and you cover your head, and you just drip and soak in the hot summer sun. I find this other suit, while it's still warm, it's not half as warm as using a traditional bee suit, and really have enjoyed it. Now, I've lost my veil along the way. Somewhere at one of the meetings, I lent it to somebody or left it somewhere. I only had one, and I've been wearing, it's forced me to wear the mesh bee suit when I go out, just to make sure I have some adequate protection. A Kevin moment here. Recently, we were at a beekeeping meeting, and Jake, who I won't say his last name, former state apiarist and the person who started our beekeeping club back in the 50s after he exited the Korean War, he mentioned something to me about the joke that I was wearing a suit and how could I do that? Why would I need to do it if I were any kind of beekeeper? Fact of the matter is, folks, don't let people do that to you. If you're not comfortable and you don't want to be stung for whatever reason, whether it's the pain or you don't want to look like Rocky punched you in the face when you go to work the next day, wear your suit, wear your veil, wear your protection as you see fit. Do not let people shame you into it. I've been keeping bees for a number of years now. I'm okay with wearing a veil. There's times when I go out and I just don't feel like it, and that I suffer the consequences on occasion. Let's see. It's June 30th. I've been stung a dozen times this year. And I did something dumb the other day. I shook in a bunch of bees into a pan to show a Varroa mite monitoring thing, and I was wearing a black shirt. Well, don't wear black when you're working the bees. I got stung like 3-4 times right away. So up until that point, through the whole season, and I've handled tens of thousands of bees, I've only been stung like 6-7 times until I did that stupid maneuver. So listen, it's okay to wear a suit. Stop telling people it's not. It's not macho to tell somebody to go without a veil. And I'll repeat a story that I heard, or a person that I know that has a droop in her eye. I've said this before, and it's because she got stung, it struck a nerve, and now she looks like she's had a stroke. And it's from a bee sting right on the corner of her eye. These things happen. Wear your protection. A responsible beekeeper wears a veil. Okay. Moving on. Mesh bee suit, very cool. Ultra Breeze is the one brand that's seen advertised I have no affinity to them. I've seen other people who are selling the same suit for the same price or less. I happened to buy mine not from Ultra Breeze, but from B-Source had a group purchase thing through the forum, and I jumped in on that because I wanted to evaluate it. Next topic, segment number 6, new Hive tool. I love my new Hive tool. It's not a conventional Hive tool. I've mentioned this, and I think I've had a picture of it. It goes down to where the hook end is, and it has a 90-degree bend and a 90-degree bend. And the premise of this is you could set it on top of an adjoining frame and pry up and pull up. After you use one of these, the old one is terrible. I set the thing down once in the garage and went out and had the old one to use, and I couldn't stand it. I couldn't wait to go get... I literally left the bee yard and went back to the garage to get the new one. This thing is the bomb. I will post a picture of it on the show notes, but this is the Hive tool of the future. If you don't have one of these, run. Don't walk. Go buy one. You will thank yourself later. Last but not least, segment number 7, the Swarm Report. If you've been following the New Jersey Swarm Report... Do you hear all that screaming upstairs? My son is playing FIFA on his Xbox, and is just having an utter and complete blast. Kevin moment, but if you do hear screaming, nobody's dying in the background. That's my son enjoying his game. Anyway, it's a rainy Sunday afternoon. What can I tell you? Swarm Report. Yes, stay focused, Kevin. New Jersey Swarm Report got to 100 swarms collected so far this year. And the 100th swarm was my swarm, ironically enough. I mentioned earlier we went and picked up a swarm. Really enjoyed that. You can go watch it. I shot a video on my new video camera, an investment that I've made. YouTube.com/NWNJBA. That's the YouTube channel. You'll see 100-something videos we have posted. One of them recently in June was a capture of a swarm. I went and entered the swarm into the swarm report and looked, and I was the 100th swarm of the year reported in there across the state of New Jersey. So that's serendipity. It's one of those things where I thought this season we would have tons and tons of swarms. And as I check around with people in the state and ask them, how many swarms have you seen? Have you seen a lot of swarms? Do you see a lot of swarms? I talked to a guy last 2 weeks ago. He captures swarms for a living. He's retired, and that's all he does. He's had 8 this year. That's crazy for him, because he usually does 8 in a week sometimes. So there's been hardly any swarms in New Jersey. I don't know what the premise of that is. Is there something going on where people are being more responsible? Don't know the answer to that. But as I talk around to other beekeepers, everybody's reporting the number of swarms is down. Now, one of the things he told me is he always collects 8 swarms a week. He's collected 8 swarms in the season. He's seen this pattern before a couple years ago. No swarms, no swarms, no swarms, no swarms. All of a sudden, boom, huge amount of swarms at the late summer. So I'm interested to see if his precognition of all this comes true. Be fascinated. And also, it'll be interesting next year to put the swarm report out and see if there's a difference through it. So, learning a lot about the swarm report, watching this, having fun generating it. If you're interested in that, you can go to nwba.njbeekeepers.org. That's the Northwest site. And on the left-hand upper corner, you can click on and look at the data for the swarm report. So we're approaching 1:15 in this time to shut it down. I wanted to say something on a sad note. My father-in-law passed away recently. That's one of the reasons why it's been so long between episodes. We went down to Florida, and I wanted to dedicate this episode to him. George, you will be missed. He really enjoyed coming up here and listening to the beekeeping stories and laughing at some of the misgivings that go on. And it's a sad time for us. We recently also went on vacation, and as always, usually a lot of things going on at work, so things have been busy. I do really enjoy doing the podcast. But again, sometimes life gets in the way, so we'll do what we can to try and crank out a couple episodes to make up for the long gap that we've had here in June since posting episode number 40. So with that, let's bring episode number 41 to a close. If you want to contact me, it's kevin@bkcorner.org. Any emails that send get answered, so please feel free to send something along. Let me know how to pronounce your name and where you're contacting us from. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.